Quick little housekeeping thing. Sorry if one or two people had called last hour to get on with Christopher Quarantino, but as you heard there on Coast to Coast, we just took a little while to kind of get to some of the core material, and by the time I looked up, suddenly it was the end of the hour, and I didn't mean to leave a couple people stranded. That will not be the case with JFK and UFO. I promise you that. Ken Thomas is a fascinating guy. And my favorite kind of researcher, even if I don't always agree with the point he makes, this guy documents everything. Love footnotes. I'm kind of a stickler about footnotes. Show me the source material. There are a ton of them in JFK and UFO, military industrial conspiracy and cover up from Maury Island to Dallas. We'll tell you about Maury Island if you don't know it. That's where the fun starts. But then we'll also talk about some of his other books like The Octopus and The Secret and Suppressed 2, which is out. And he himself is very interesting on the way on Coast to Coast. So a quick little update. We mentioned before about the story about Jesus Diaz, the Border Patrol agent who was prosecuted in what critics on this show called this sort of outrageous miscarriage of justice. It's an overreach by the Justice Department that was aimed at placating anonymous Mexican officials in some sort of quid pro quo that we don't know about. And the family is fighting back. We did a whole show about it, which you can go back and listen to if you sign up for Coast Insider. You can listen to it anytime. The legal organization that's carrying the water for the family on this is trying very hard to get Agent Diaz, A, out of trouble in general, but out of jail. And this week I was told by an insider that the Justice Department is demanding that the family seal all of their records, that the court seal all of the records pertaining to this case as a way of trying to shut down, I guess, further interviews like we had last week and like the family has been doing around the country. So I tell you that now just because that's what I was told, and it's very interesting, and we'll track that story coming up. And also another update. This one I got on my Deacon Punnett Twitter account, DEACON, Deacon Punnett, two N's, two T's, from Johnny B500, who heard us when we were talking about on the death of Amy Winehouse, that the fact that she died at the age of 27, too. And this was his tweet. Amy Winehouse, Jim Morrison, Jimi Hendrix, and Brian Jones, all dead at the age of 27. And then he goes on to write, Justin Bieber turns 27 in 2021. Patience. Now, that's just mean. It's just mean but funny to say patience. This is wrong. He doesn't have any of the problems that any of those others had, and hope he doesn't. Anyway, so from there, we go back to the real conspiracies. What is happening? And how can you tell the real ones from the ones that, people just kind of guessing at? Well, it's research by people like this guy, Ken Thomas, coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Ken Thomas, where have you been all my life?
Ian, it's good to meet you at last.
I love your work. And I don't know that we'll end up agreeing on everything, but I just love the amount of time that you spent looking into these things and making these connections. Even though they be connections that others might not see, you do. And I commend you for JFK and UFO. It is, if nothing else, a very entertaining read. And people ought to take a look at this. And I haven't read The Octopus, but I do have The Secret and Suppressed 2, which I'll be savoring over Christmas vacation coming up.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for the compliments on my research work. My favorite quote about JFK and UFO is from a guy named Greg Bishop. He said, it's information rich to the point of saturation.
See, I'll go along with that. But you know what? I mean, someone's got to do it. And I just love the fact that there are these really unusual connections between the Maury Island UFO case and JFK. And from there, which will, and we'll get back to this coming up, just how strong, you know, a bold line we can draw or a dotted line we can draw, it still just makes you go, wow, that's weird. So let's talk about Maury Island first, because this is a case that is known to some, but it doesn't have quite the marquee value, say, of Mount Rainier or, you know, obviously Roswell. So talk about Maury Island for the uninitiated.
Okay, sure. Well, that's what's interesting about this, is that the Maury Island case remains really obscure, even though it has all these really firm connections to the JFK assassination, which is, you know, anything but obscure, you know, and people discuss recent political history. And it's all about this set of flying saucers that were first witnessed by a man named Harold Dahl in the Puget Sound area up in the state of Washington near Tacoma on June 21st, 1947. He was out on a boat in the harbor there, and several flying saucers appeared over his ship. One of them was actually wobbling, right?
What kind of ship are we talking about, by the way, too?
We're talking about flying saucers. You know,
what kind of ship was he in, the kind of ship he was in?
Oh, the North Queen. Yeah. Well, actually, one of the confusing things about it is that for many years it was reported that he was a civil patrolman, but he's not. It's a business up there where you can, when logs break free from logging operations, each log has a brand on it, and people can go out and recover the logs that are missing and bring them back to the lumber company that was responsible for them and get a reward. So that's the kind of work that he was doing. So it was kind of like a harbor patrol boat, but it didn't have anything to do with, civil defense.
But it has a safety aspect to it. And these, and I know this because of the Great Lakes, these waterlogged logs sink down and become like torpedoes just underneath the surface. So it's really important to get them out because they can easily take out a ship or two and do all the time.
Oh, that's a very good point. But again, I don't think that the people who were on the boat were doing it for safety reasons. They were doing it, you know, it was their job. They were making money.
Right. Well, I'm sure, but it's also one of the reasons why you got to get them out. And that's one of the reasons why the companies will pay for that, because they don't want the financial responsibility of having one of their logs having sunk somebody else's ship. So they get these logs out. And that's what this guy is doing for a living.
That's right. That's right. And actually, the safety factor goes also to the idea that to the questions of their sobriety. You know, that what happened to them, they're doing their job, they're trying to make money, and again, as you said, it's a safety dimension to the whole thing. So, I mean, they're not just goofing around,
right?
In other words, when these flying saucers show up, and these ships, these are, again, flying saucers. They're Dahl describes them as convex, not concave, and there's half a dozen of them, and the central one is wobbling around, flopping around, and it's spewing out two different kinds of substances, a black one and a white one, and that's hitting the water. And the white stuff is actually causing the water to steam, and it's just falling all over this patrol boat. And it hits Dahl's son in the arm, injures him, hits their dog, they had a dog on the ship, and kills the dog.
The white or the black stuff?
It's the black stuff.
Okay, the black stuff hits the dog and kills the dog.
I believe so, yeah. So all this crazy stuff is going on. And, because of the injury and because, you know, first of all, they have to throw the dog carcass in the water, and they have to take the boat to the shore. And what happens with the flying saucers is that one of the saucers taps the other one, according to Dahl's account, and straightens it up, stops it from wobbling, and then they all fly off. Okay? That's the first original Maury Island case. And the point you're making before is that this happened actually 3 days before Mount Rainier. And I assume everybody listening knows that Mount Rainier was the first of the modern waves, Kenneth Arnold sightings. We're still several days in the future. So the Maury Island case is actually the first event of the modern wave.
And so what does he do? Having seen this, having lost the family dog in front of his son and giving it an impromptu burial at sea, what do they do with this information?
Well, Dahl takes it to the guy that he says owns the boat. Although if you check the registration log of the North Queen, which is the name of the boat, it's actually registered under Harold Dahl's name. So that's the curious stuff starts to begin to happen almost immediately. But he goes to the guy who owns the boat and who is his business partner in this lumber salvage operation. And that guy's name is Fred Crisman. And Crisman comes down the next day and to verify, again, he thinks, well, what's Dahl talking about? Is he drunk? Did he wreck the ship? You know, what is the story right about flying saucers? He goes down the next day and he sees a flying saucer of his own.
At so night?
Actually, no, this is during the day.
In the actual daytime, that's fine. So in the day, they go down the next day, and he sees one in the daytime standing next to him, and the other guy has to say, I told you so.
Well, he doesn't have Dahl with him at that point, as far as I know. Crisman sees his own, he has his own sighting by himself. In fact, there's a question as to whether he really did or not. Is he making that up? This is to make himself part of the story.
Okay. And I love the fact that you include that fact, because that's only fair. And we don't know. In a way, part of what's interesting about this whole guy, Fred Crisman, is kind of his sketchiness, right? I mean, it's kind of what also makes him intriguing. He says some things which, when you try to figure it out later on, you don't know necessarily whether to believe him. And then sometimes he says something outrageous and it really pans out. So, that's the kind of thing. Right. It's like, what? Who is this guy, Fred Crisman? But so he's listed. So Dahl calls him the owner of the boat in the Maury Island incident, which happened days before the famous Mount Rainier sighting. But he's not listed as the owner of the boat. We don't know whether he was a silent partner, whether it was a 60-40 split. The other guy put his name on the title. Who knows? But for whatever reason, he's involved. And he sees something, so he says, the next day. Then what?
Okay, well, again, Crisman, as we go through the story, we'll see how this progresses, but Crisman becomes actually the central figure in the whole story. And that's because he's the guy who's directly connected to the Kennedy assassination. I know we don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves.
Right.
But just to keep the listeners on board here,
sure,
we should mention that Fred Crisman is the guy that Jim Garrison suspected of being the grassy knoll shooter in the Kennedy assassination almost 20 years later, 15 years later.
So let's just say, let's remember the name Fred Crisman. He'll come up again.
Fred Crisman.
Sorry.
Right.
But Dahl, part of what I was getting at was that Dahl gets a visit, the earliest known, it would seem, documented visit from the Men in Black.
Right. Well, and actually, that's very important. It's very important to understanding why people have dismissed this story and why so many of your listeners, I'm sure right now, are saying to themselves, well, how come, if this is such an important event, how come I've never heard about it? It's because UFO researchers and writers over the years have dismissed it as a hoax, that it's just Dahl and Crisman hoaxing people. And that's because of what happened to Dahl. Whereas Fred Crisman, got into it and became a celebrity almost about it, Dahl continued to tell the story to people, and he got a visit from the Men in Black. And I don't know if people have background on the Men in Black here on the show, but I recently wrote an introduction to a book called Casebook on the Men in Black. So if you want to try to understand what that phenomenon is all about.
No, well, let's stop down for a second and talk about that. Because I do think that, I mean, we know Men in Black from the movies. We know Men in Black from popular culture. But what do you know about the Men in Black? What would you say is what we can know, verifiable, about the Men in Black?
Well, what we know in this case is that they came to Harold Dahl and said to him, as they do in all these cases, and then this is a repeated pattern about the Men in Black. These strange people show up with their dark glasses, their black shoes, their whole black getup, and they told Dahl, listen, you're going to stop talking about this. They actually took him out to lunch one day, and they said, and they repeated to him the story. And at that point, not too many people knew the story. It was actually under investigation by Kenneth Arnold himself at the time. And so Dahl sits down with this guy, this Man in Black guy, and he listens to his story being told back to him, details that the guy couldn't possibly have read in the paper or heard from anybody. And you know, at first blush, Darl said, you know, I don't know you. You're not going to tell me to shut up, you know, and he continues to talk about the story to people. And thereafter, his son, recovered from the incident, disappears. His wife gets deathly ill. The lumber salvaging business just goes to pot. His whole life begins to become a shipwreck of sorts, just as the man in black had threatened. And then at that point, you know, Dahl says, whoa, these people aren't kidding. And he, at that point, he said he was going to, from thereafter, he was going to declare it a hoax and try to get it out of his life. So from that point on, people kind of took him at his word and said, you know, it was a hoax. It was a hoax. But he was saying it was a hoax because he was threatened in the very classic man in black pattern. But he's going to, you know, show up after UFO events all the time and threaten the witnesses and try to keep them quiet about it.
Based on your research, Ken Thomas, and this is why I know I can, throughout many times during the course of the evening, I think we're going to, I'll digress into something which I think you know, even if I don't know you know it, but what do we know about the agency that would be providing these, you know, these men in black? There's been some speculation about, you know, what governmental department they are attached to. What do you think? What do we know about the men in black?
I mean, what it was called in 1947?
Or in 47? And what are they a part of? Part of the Pentagon? Part of what?
Well, they're part of, and this is the subtitle of the book, the military-industrial complex. And I know that's like a big, broad term, and
right.
You know, a lot of details can hide behind it. But, I mean, you can't really call it the CIA. You call it the OSS. You could call it, I mean, there's a whole alphabet soup of agencies. But what it is this bureaucratic setup designed to inject a cover-up into areas and events that happen where secret technology is exposed to people, where, you know, alien contact or whatever, all those kinds of things, in order for them, you know, to assert some control over things that they either don't understand or don't want people to know about.
So who do we,
yeah,
how do we think they get this? How do we think they get this information? I mean, like, how do they know to go to Dahl's house?
From what we know, they're constantly monitoring it. The military is, you know, this is actually happening before the Air Force separates from the Army as a different branch, and you really have to get into how this thing was investigated. And we have to talk about Kenneth Arnold and how he was hired to investigate it. And he introduced a couple of, we call them Air Force investigators, but again, that was before the Air Force, who were working for Nathan Twining and Carl Spatz, all these military generals and higher-ups, whose mission was to do precisely this kind of thing, you know, to monitor what was going on with this flying saucer situation. So that's where it comes from.
Right. So the Men in Black then might be as much less a governmental organization as it is an organization that may be funded by private contractors, by Lockheed Martin or other groups like that?
Well, it is a military/industrial complex, yes.
Okay.
Yes. And as you get farther into it, in fact, when you start talking about Chrisman as possible assassin to Kennedy, the person, the group that Garrison thought Chrisman was working for was Boeing up in Seattle, aerospace contractors. So yeah.
Okay. That's kind of what I was trying to pin down a little bit about who's where and who's getting a paycheck from whom on this. All right. So again, we're talking with Ken Thomas. The book is JFK and UFO. And the Maury Island UFO incident, which comes days before the Mount Rainier incident, according to many, is the start of the story of Fred Chrisman. And we just said, remember that name, because this is where it gets really interesting. So let's now that that Dahl, the original citer of the UFO, has renounced his story after a visit from the Men in Black. We'll get to the case of Fred Chrisman next. And what did he start to do? And what were some of the ways in which this incident becomes tied to the JFK assassination, including some very well-known names in the Garrison investigation would show up in Maury Island. It's too weird. We'll get to that coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. JFK and UFO, military industrial conspiracy and cover up from Maury Island to Dallas, one of many books written by Ken Thomas. We'll talk about the connection and just who some of the characters were better known for the JFK assassination that start to pop up in the life of the Maury Island investigation and Fred Crisman in particular. Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. So Ken Thomas, author of JFK and UFO and other books, is exposing in a book that this book's been out for a couple of years now, right, Ken?
Actually, JFK and UFO, the current book has only been out for less than a year. It is okay. Based on a book that I wrote many years ago, but it's almost a completely different book. I rewrote the entire old text and included a whole bunch of research I had accumulated since then.
Well, that's fair. I'm just saying, because you've been on Coast to Coast, for some people that are hearing this go, well, I think that sounds like something I've heard before. But I insisted on doing this because I was reading it. I just fell in love with it. So the guy, Guy Bannister, we know the name Guy Bannister. People who have been following the JFK assassination know that name. In the movie that was done by his name escapes me for the moment.
Oliver Stone.
Oliver Stone. It was done so well by Ed Asner. I thought Ed Asner did this great character, right? I don't know how close he was to the original Guy Bannister, but it's a memorable portrayal by the otherwise affable Ed Asner.
Yes, Lou Grant, right, and from the Mary Tyler Moore Show,
right. And otherwise,
notorious figures in the Kennedy assassination,
right. And otherwise, you know, kind of he totally pulls off this character, even though it's like good old Lou Grant, but he like completely pulls this off. The idea is that Guy Bannister was even a controversial figure during the course of the JFK assassination. He was a retired FBI guy who had high clearances in counterintelligence, who was dabbling in creating the insurgency groups which were going to take back Cuba, and at the same time private investigations, and all of this wound around this office in New Orleans, not far away from where Lee Harvey Oswald was working, and in fact, Lee Harvey Oswald and he were interacting all the time.
Right. Oswald was kind of working for Bannister. It was the same building. They were in the same building. But the point to be made here is that Guy Bannister is a figure in the Maury Island case in the late 40s. He was the special agent in charge up there in the Pacific Northwest handling that case. So, you know, it's not just Crisman that has all the connections between the first.
So how weird is that? The guy Bannister himself connects back to Maury Island as the guy who's called upon to go door to door when somebody has information that they'd like the woman who said that she found this very small alien craft. Yeah, talk about that if you would. Tell that story.
Yeah, this made the papers, actually, and I've got it reproduced in the book, the headlines. A small 30-inch flying saucer was turned over to Guy Bannister. Again, as an FBI special agent in charge at that point. And it was in the papers for several days until military personnel were sent out, said something to Bannister, and then the story changed that it wasn't really a saucer. It was some kind of thing that some kids put together from a phonograph record. Years later, before the assassination, Bannister actually supplied testimony to the Louisiana House on American Activities Committee, saying that this was actually a Fugo balloon.
I'm sorry, a what? The Japanese balloons?
Balloon? Yeah, the Japanese balloons. That's what he said. But this is, of course, right after making a public confession that all he was really doing was working counterintelligence in that area in the 1940s. So you can't believe what he says. And, you know, the Fugo balloon explanation has been blown apart many times, because those were balloons that were launched by the Japanese in like 1945, and the idea that they could have stayed aloft for 2 years
is crazy, right?
But not likely.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's where Bannister was. And Bannister again appears in Jim Garrison's autobiography.
Right.
Garrison was also working for the FBI in the Pacific Northwest at the time, and he says that he knew Bannister, that they got together all the time, and that they talked about these things. And surely, if Bannister was, you know, wrapped up in this public UFO thing, and he and Bannister were talking, the idea that they exchanged information about the Maury Island case seems to be almost inevitable. But when you see Garrison picking up the trail in 1968, he never says a thing about knowing about Chrisman previously as part of that thing. It's one of
right.
A couple of events where Chrisman's presence is actually on the scene is telegraphed in advance. The other one is when Kenneth Arnold was originally hired to investigate the Maury Island case. He was hired by the pulp magazine publisher Ray Palmer, who knew who Chrisman was before Maury Island too, because he had published letters that Chrisman had.
Okay,
written, but he never.
We're going to get ahead of ourselves here, and I'm afraid we're going to lose people because there's so much stuff here. So hang on. Let me lay down some footsteps for people who, unlike you, wrote the book or me, read the book. So again, just to wrap up the Guy Bannister thought is that. Isn't that interesting that it's Guy Bannister that's doing the investigation? Guy Bannister of the FBI later on to the JFK assassination theory. Guy Bannister is the one providing disinformation. A woman comes forward with this this small alien craft, which is even reported in the paper as that, and then suddenly it gets dismissed as a hoax or a Japanese bomb from World War II. Sorry, and it just all seems very preposterous, but the fact that it's Guy Bannister and Jim Garrison there at the same time just again draws this very interesting connection between the UFO incident at Maury Island and JFK. Right. Now, back to Fred Chrisman. Because Fred Chrisman, now he's the co-owner, or we think, of the boat that had this original Maury Island sighting on it. And it's Fred Chrisman then who starts to sort of take front and center in this because he's writing letters. He's writing letters and he's getting published talking about different stories, right?
Well, no, that actually happens before the Maury Island incident. Fred Chrisman first comes on the scene by having a letter printed in Amazing Stories, one of those pulp magazines that they published in the 40s, in which he tells the story of fighting these strange creatures in Burma called the Deros. That were part of a kind of a broader thing called the Shaver Mystery that the pulp magazines were publishing. So Chrisman is there, and that's in a Ray Palmer pulp. Then there's a report in Harper's Weekly about the first science fiction convention that mentions Chrisman in a critical way, and Chrisman writes another letter in response to that. So Palmer publishes all this stuff. So that Chrisman is known to readers of science fiction pulp magazines before the incident happens.
Now, the Deros things are weird, though. I have to say, if we're going to talk, we have to put all our cards up on the table. The claim that Fred Chrisman made, which was originally then in a letter to the editor of this magazine, was that while he was serving in Burma during World War II, he had come across these underground robots, right?
Well, the Deros, right. The Deros is a contraction of the term detrimental robot.
Okay.
And it was coined by a guy named Richard Shaver, who was a miner in Trent, Pennsylvania, who started picking up signals from his mining equipment about a lost civilization that lives in underground caverns around the world called the Deros.
Right. Called the Deros.
Yes, and this
he wrote stories about that,
right? And that became the Shaver Mystery. And when Ray Palmer started publishing that stuff, and it was presented as true things, not as science fiction. It became the most popular stuff that he had published. And Chrisman kind of joined the bandwagon because he said he too had an encounter with the Deros over there in Burma. That they shot him in the arm with a laser-like beam. You know, this is before the laser was invented. A popular kind of thing in science fiction. So Chrisman was connecting up to that. Now, the significant part in terms of the investigation here is that Ray Palmer, the guy that published all of Richard Shaver's stuff, including Chrisman's letter, after he heard about the Maury Island case, he sent a note off to Kenneth Arnold. And quick review of Kenneth Arnold, 3 days after Maury Island, Kenneth Arnold sees these chevrons flying across up by Mount Rainier while he's in his plane looking for a crashed marine transport plane. He sees these chevrons. He comes back. He tells people. A newspaper guy says gives his description of how they look like saucers skipping across water, and that's where we get the term flying saucers. So Kenneth Arnold becomes really the first national celebrity about flying saucers. So Palmer writes to him and says, hey, these guys had this thing happen to them in Maury Island, and I will give you $200 if you go investigate it. So he became the chief investigator of the Maury Island thing. Arnold did.
And that's how the famous Ken Arnold gets involved in it.
That's exactly right. And then he draws in the military after that. So I'm pausing here because I don't know which tributary we want to go down. They're all so fascinating.
That's very good thinking. Because we can. I mean, there's lots of different little avenues. So I tell you what, let's avoid the tributaries for now. Let's stay on the main river. So Fred Crisman, again, he starts to sort of emerge as a guy who isn't just a writer of letters. He's a guy who becomes a shaper of the story of Maury Island, and he becomes much more attached to it than the person, his former partner, who was the one who was the original sighter of the UFOs. Fair description?
Yes. Okay. That's very true. That's very true. And Crisman seems to be enacting a role kind of similar to the Men in Black. He seems to be dissembling the thing, trying to subvert the investigation.
Okay, so then let's fast forward a little bit in time, and because I want to make sure that we get to, and there's a lot to get to when it comes to the JFK assassination. We're hovering right around like 1947, 48. So what does Fred Crisman do over the next few years? What does he start to do for a living? What is his career choice? How does Fred Crisman stay kind of at least, if only peripherally, in the public eye?
Well, eventually, of course, he totally disappears. But his job record is, of course, fascinating. He applied, for instance, to the nuclear plant there, the Hanford nuclear facility there. And many people believe that the Maury Island thing was just a story to cover up nuclear dumping from that plant. But for the most part, he's still working with Dahl on the lumber salvage thing throughout the investigation, if he's working at all. But a nuclear plant worker, and then he
disappears. How does he disappear?
After all the significant stuff that happens for the Maury Island case, let me just jump into this. After a while, Kenneth Arnold doesn't know what to make of this stuff. They're both Dahl and Crisman supposedly have some of that flag, some of that junk that the flying saucers spewed out. And they brought some to Arnold, and he didn't know what to make of it, and he didn't know what to make of the story. It all sounded very confusing. After, of course, Arnold, when he began the investigation, had a very number of strange things happen to him as well. The hotel room that he was staying at was obviously bugged and these kind of things. At one point, though, he decides that he's got to bring, there needs to be some kind of government intervention here, some military investigators. So he called people that he knew, two guys, Lieutenants Davidson and Brown, who came in to do an investigation of their own. They collected the slag from Crisman and Dahl, and they put it on a plane and were heading back to Wright Field to test it and to continue the investigation when their plane crashed, and both of those men were killed. Now, one of the theories about this whole thing is that Crisman sabotaged the plane because, he didn't want, really, the story to get out any further. Hmm. So, and that Crisman had a role in getting that hotel room bugged, and that everything that was happening there was part of his role as some kind of a counterintelligence operative guy, asserting control over a situation that was getting out of hand.
But not just counterintelligence. I mean, then he falls into the category of assassin.
Well, of course, that's the whole big point, right? Garrison believes that he is, in fact, Kennedy's assassin. And some people have speculated that maybe this was how he got that job.
That's the connection.
Either covering this up. He's got all this information, and he's and that's why he disappears, because he tells the people, look, if you don't give me, you know, the choice assignments in this world that I live in, I'm going to expose this. In fact, for many years, Crisman said, remember that old television show, The Invaders, with Roy Thinnes?
Right.
Remember that show?
I love that show.
Yeah. Crisman said that show was about him, you know, that it was based on his life, that he knew the secret of the invaders and that people were trying to, you know, keep him from getting it out.
What was the deal with the invaders? They had a pinky finger thing or something? Wasn't they missing a pinky finger?
That's the only way you could tell they were an alien, if they were pinky fingers. But the very interesting thing about this is that The Invaders, as you recall, was a Quinn Martin production, right?
Right, right after The Fugitive.
Yeah, and the FBI.
Right.
And when Mark Felt died, you know that name because when he died, it was exposed that he is Deep Throat in the Watergate case. When he died, it came out that he was, in fact, a consultant to the FBI show, which was a Quinn Martin production. So the idea that these shows have connections actually to the real spook world was pretty solidly put there at that point.
Yeah.
But only later, and only very recently, after my book was written, it had come out that Felt was the guy that reviewed job applications for the Hanford nuclear plant, where Crisman...
Okay, stop, stop, stop. So wait, the guy who was later revealed to be Deep Throat was in the 40s. He was working as
in the Pacific Northwest.
In the Pacific Northwest for what would it be, the Department of Justice or the Department of Defense or whatever, to review applications to work at the nuclear plant there?
I guess it was the FBI. Yeah,
okay.
And if you start adding it up, I mean, Crisman had all these people, you know, Bannister, Garrison, all these people knew who Crisman was.
Who knew Fred Crisman? That's just too weird. Okay, so but then
just to put the final spin on Bannister, we know that Oswald and Bannister worked together in the same building. Oswald was passing out Fair Play for Cuba leaflets.
Right.
Which was a fake cover. Oswald was not really a leftist. Whatever he did, it had nothing to do with any kind of real activism. So, and he was working for Bannister. So Bannister was dissembling again. He was kind of trying to covering up, just as he did with that flying saucer, just as he admitted he did with the House on American Activities Committee. He's on hand to distort the picture, to cover it up, to move investigators in wrong directions.
Okay, all connecting. And that's why we, you know, the title JFK and UFO, simple, sweet, says it. And Fred Crisman is kind of the and in the title JFK and UFO. It's sort of Fred Crisman is the little part in the middle there that says these are how these two things are connected. Now there's a period of time where it appears as though Fred Crisman kind of drops off the map for a little bit. And the next time that we see, we see him entering into the public consciousness is as the one of the three hobos, as it's described, that was arrested just after the assassination of JFK. So go ahead.
Yes, well, that's absolutely right. And in fact, Jim, these photographs of the hobos are pretty famous. Jim Garrison actually took them on the Johnny Carson show one night. And he was just about ready to say, see, this guy, Fred Crisman, when Johnny Carson cut him off and went to a commercial over, you know, concerns that Garrison was going to be saying too much.
Don't tell me that Johnny Carson knew Fred Crisman, because then I'm going to say you're a liar.
Johnny
Carson and Fred Crisman did a magic act together in Nebraska or something. I'm going to think you're making this up. So,
one thing I should make a point about, too, Oliver Stone has been in the news recently. He talks about how the movie that he made was a counter myth to the Warren Commission thing, which isn't exactly right. I mean, Garrison did an actual investigation. It's not a counter myth. It's there's documentation here. But you don't see Fred Crisman mentioned in the movie JFK.
No.
Even though it's very clear anywhere you read that Garrison is saying this is the trigger man in the grassy knoll. And the toehold idea. The movie is about Clay Shaw, the guy that Garrison eventually took to court, the guy that he had.
Right.
He felt that he had enough stuff on that he could convict. You know, he could never really bring Crisman because he never really had what it would take to get a conviction.
Okay, but we gotta hang on to that thought. We'll come back to that because You mentioned Clay Shaw, and then that's another moment of a connection between JFK and UFO, and we'll get to that next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.